Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this is episode 182. And I'm very excited to bring to you this week, Kyle Reyes. Now, Kyle is the national spokesman for Law Enforcement Today. He is the founder of the Whiskey Patriots and Behind the Uniforms, as well as the CEO of the Silent Partner marketing firm. So although not a sworn first responder himself, he's one of the many, many citizens who is very passionate about our community and does a lot to show support and give exposure to the stories that are out there, the men and women that are protecting their communities. So really, really enjoyed this conversation. Very different than, you know, some of the law enforcement and military that I have on. But again, that common denominator, that common ground where that common sense kind of resonates regarding a lot of the issues that we discuss. So as I always say before we start the interview, please go to your podcast apps, subscribe to the show, rate the show, and then most importantly, use your social media and share these incredible stories that we have from these men and women on this podcast. So with that being said, I introduce to you Kyle Reyes. Enjoy. All right. Well, Kyle, I want to say initially, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. I know we've been going back and forth for a little while, but I'm glad we're making it happen today.
I appreciate you having me. I'm sorry that it took forever to coordinate my schedule. I've had so much travel the last, probably years since we were introduced.
Yeah, no problem at all. All right. Well, the first question I always ask is, where are we finding you geographically today?
So we are in the People's Republic of Connecticut, as I lovingly refer to it.
All right. And were you born there?
I was born and raised in New Jersey, moved up to Massachusetts as a teenager, and then I was working in television when I made the transition over to Connecticut.
All right. So if you didn't mind, because I'd love to hear the kind of backstory of what made you, you know, who you are and your passion for law enforcement. So what was your family unit like? What did your parents do and how many siblings did you have?
So, two siblings, a younger brother, a younger sister. Unfortunately for them, I got all the looks in the family. also the brains and the charming personality and the humility. But no, seriously, we grew up in New Jersey. We were super poor growing up. My parents both worked three jobs so that we could afford to eat. They skipped meals and didn't want us to know it. But when you're growing up, you sort of pick up on that stuff. And they really instilled in us a sense of humility and pride and hard work and honesty and integrity and Christianity. And so we moved up when I was 13 years old to Massachusetts. After I graduated, I went into work in television. So I was full-time in TV. I was also full-time in college. And I worked my way through. I have a lot of family in law enforcement or in the service. My little brother actually just came back from a year in Bahrain. He's in the Coast Guard. I've got family who are, officers all over the country. And working in TV, I really started seeing all the attacks on law enforcement. I saw cops get no longer the benefit of the doubt, but instead conviction in the court of public opinion. And so when I left TV back in 2000, I guess it was probably about 2008, I started a marketing agency. I had no idea how to run a company. I knew how to market. I knew how to storytell, but I didn't know the first thing about running a company. And so I finally started hiring people who were a lot smarter than me. And that's when the company really exploded. And it's, you know, our core values are faith, family, and forward thinking. God is the CEO of my company. I'm just the guy who's sort of been tapped to run it from a, you know, day-to-day execution perspective. My family is everything to me. We're blessed to have two kids and a third one on the way. My wife is much smarter and much better looking than me. I don't know what she's doing. She must have thought that I had money or something. I don't know. But she's amazing. And so we really just built into the core DNA of our company, God, family, and serving those who serve.
Brilliant. And on your career path when you were young, you weren't called to the military or law enforcement yourself initially?
Man, I was so fat growing up, it wasn't even funny. Like, I maxed out at 328 pounds my senior year in high school. So even if I had wanted to, it never would have been in the cards for me.
All right, well, there's a story right there. So let's talk about that. How did you go from 328 back to the slim gentleman I just saw on the video?
He's far from slim. The gentleman that you just saw in the video who's still wearing gym clothes still loves bourbon and bacon. But, you know, what it came down to, man, is that I went to the doctor one day and I was 18 years old and he was like, "Do you like being alive?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." He was like, "Cool. Well, you're going to die unless you lose weight." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Well, that's great." And I was working in TV at that point. And so I figured maybe at some point I wanted to do some on-air stuff. I wasn't really sure at that point. But I interviewed the world's strongest man. He was in the Guinness Book of World Records for pulling a Carnival cruise ship. It was pretty cool stuff. And he sat down with me one day after the interview and he said, "Man, you're pretty fat, but I think I could fix that." And I was like, "Well, you don't pull any punches." He said, "Have you ever thought about powerlifting?" And I got into powerlifting and it was amazing, amazing stress relief. And then I just really developed a hunger and a passion for hitting the gym hard. And the rest is history. I still love bacon.
Which strongman was that?
God, I don't even remember the guy's name, to be honest with you. That was back in probably 2003. I remember what he looked like. He was a big dude. And in the interview, in the first interview that we did, I had one of my reporters sit in the driver's seat of an 18-wheeler and he pulled the 18-wheeler with a rope attached to it while she was doing her stand-up in the beginning. It was pretty cool stuff. Man, I'm going to have to look back and look the guy's name up because it's been a long time.
Yeah, it was interesting what the doctor said as well, though. You need that brutal honesty, you know what I mean? I think the problem, you know, an issue that we see now is a lot of physicians who are like, "Well, we'll give you a whole bunch of medication that will help lower your blood pressure and bring your cholesterol down," instead of address the underlying issue.
Exactly.
All right. Well, then, so you said you were in television. You know, when was that pivotal moment when you decided to switch from a regular station to spearheading your own and then adding in that law enforcement component?
I've always had an entrepreneurial drive through and through. I mean, I remember back in second grade, it's actually going in the book that I'm writing right now. We went to Catholic school growing up, and in second grade, we would go over to the convent for typing class. And there, underneath the convent, we had the old Apple IIe computers. And you would take typing class, and Sister Gertrude would oversee it. And if you finished your typing class before everybody else, you could spend the rest of the class time left playing a game called the Lemonade Stand. And in the Lemonade Stand, they would tell you what the forecast was going to be for the next day. And they would tell you how much cups and lemons and sugar and water were. And then based on the forecast and how much money you had, you would buy the ingredients. And then you would set the price for the lemonade for the next day. And then based on what the weather turned up to do, it would tell you how much you sold and how much money you made. So second grade, really the roots of entrepreneurship sort of took hold for me. I was told a story afterwards about how my mother worked as a veterinary technician, and the wife of the guy that owned the practice said to me one day, we were out there, she was watching us, and I said, "I'd like to make some money." And she said, "Well, I don't really have any work for you to do." And I guess I said, and I don't have any memory of this, I guess I said, "Well, you have all these rocks all over your yard, how about you pay me to pick them up?" And she said, "Okay, how about I pay you a penny a pound?" And I guess I said, "Why don't we instead talk about a price per rock?" So I was negotiating at a really, really young age. In TV, I was working 80 to 100 hours a week. I was on salary, so there was no overtime or any extra money or anything like that. And I knew that one day I was going to want to have a family. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to afford to do that in the position that I was in. I also knew that I wasn't helping people anymore. I really wanted to go on TV to tell untold stories. And it wasn't happening because if it bleeds, it leads. And there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot of truth to that. And so finally, after seeing all these attacks on law enforcement, after talking to family and friends who were sick and tired of being convicted in the court of public opinion, thanks to a 7-second out of context body cam footage clip that made the mainstream news, I knew that there was something more that had to be done. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it just running my own marketing agency, but I had to start somewhere and I had to build that into our core values.
Right. So where we are now, and let's take a broad spectrum with all the mainstream media that's out there, left and right. What do you think they're doing wrong these days? How have they become led astray from just reporting to the news to the sensationalisms that we're seeing now?
Oh, two words, social media. The mainstream news is now dictated by social media because everybody has a voice and everybody has an opinion and everybody believes that their voice and their opinion is right. And so the media is now reactionary and is jumping in when a video goes viral, and they have to weigh in and build a news article around it, even if they don't have any facts or data outside of that 7-second out of context clip. And so social media has really driven everything. And then, of course, you've got these Hollywood elites who think that they know better than everybody else, who live in their own bubble behind their own wall and declare that the world is a perfectly safe place filled with, you know, sunshine and bubbles and Oreo cookies and people holding hands, singing Kumbaya, smelling like patchouli. And that's not what the real world is.
Yeah, it's interesting observing as well, because you get the two sides, you know, whatever you want to label them. And there's this venomous, you know, rock throwing over, you know, minutia in a lot of places. And it seems to me from the outside looking in that there's a middle group of people that are like, hey, this is where the truth kind of hangs out in the middle between you two extremes. And while you're fighting over, you know, again, like you said, sensationalism, a tweet or, you know, whatever was done, there are police officers dying. There are teachers, you know, struggling to get by when they're trying to educate our kids. There are, you know, there's a drug epidemic in this country. And it seems to me that it's this distraction as well, where the sensationalism not only makes the news, but also negates all the real things that we're trying to fix.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at where we are in society these days, whether you love him or hate him, Trump nailed one thing, which was the idea of the silent majority. It was the idea that there's an overwhelming number of people who just want to provide for their families, bust their butts, spend time with loved ones, support those who serve and protect our communities and our country. And it was the silent majority that has shifted elections in the course of history here in America, not just in this last election cycle, but over time. And so the idea that the squeaky wheel gets the grease is something that can't be lost on us in society. I think that he absolutely nailed it with the idea of the silent majority.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's you know, that's something that I think that people seem to have lost the concept of, which is whoever is in that White House in D.C. or in, you know, the House of Commons in England or wherever you live, that's not the person who dictates how you run your country. We are, like you said, the silent majority, and that whole we the people concept seems to have been forgotten. And I think that when you see people band together about something they're passionate about, they realize, oh, we are the voice of this country and we can change things.
No doubt. I totally agree with that.
Right. So then, well, as far as law enforcement, because I know that's an area that you know, have focused on, and is Behind the New Uniforms your project as well?
Yeah. So it all started about 3 years ago. We did a pro bono video for the Manchester, Connecticut Police and Fire Departments, and it was called The Holiday Prayer. And we featured a lot of men and women in uniform, and they sort of read this script or this prayer, and we laid over B-roll from them out in the field and them fighting fires and so on and so forth. And the video went viral. It was about a week before Christmas, and it got 3 million views in like a day. So I made some calls. I got the chiefs on Fox and Friends. And when Ainsley Earnhardt was interviewing them, she said, "Who made this video?" And they said, you know, there's this campaign. At that point, my agency had announced that we were going to be donating $500,000 to tell the stories behind the uniforms. So they started talking about the campaign, and you would think it would be amazing exposure. Well, it was actually sort of the opposite. Within about 15 minutes, we were overrun with Antifa and all of their supporters, who started leaving fake one-star reviews on Facebook. And they said if we didn't shut down our campaign, they were going to put us out of business for supporting pigs and killers and Nazis. And so my management team got, you know, understandably really nervous. And they said, what are we going to do? I mean, that's the kind of thing, man. It'll put a company under. And so I said, well, guys, there's really only one thing that we can do. And they said, kill the campaign. I said, no, screw that. We're going to double our donation and tell them all to kiss our American asses. I don't know if I could say asses on your show, but I just did twice.
You can say whatever you want on this one.
Okay, cool. Good. And so we then at that point, I had about 100,000 followers on my public figure page on Facebook. So I instructed my staff to go respond to these fake reviews and these trolls by trolling them right back. And so they left some really fun and aggressive and in-your-face responses. And then we took screenshots of the trolls' comments, our responses, and then we put them up on my public figure page. And then people started going and attacking those trolls and leaving 5-star reviews. And we just went to war, because when you do the right thing and you double down on patriotism and God and country above self, you'll win in the long run. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And so we doubled the campaign to $1 million in pledged services. And one of those layers, if you will, was this show called Behind the Uniforms. So we have what's become sort of an iconic whiskey wall here at our studios in Connecticut. And the way that the show works is that active or retired emergency responders or members of our service, they come to the whiskey wall, they bring a bottle of whiskey. We sit and on camera, we share a cocktail and they tell you about a good day on the job and a lousy day on the job and what they're doing now. And then their name goes on the bottle and the bottle goes on the wall. And so we have literally hundreds and hundreds of stories here at the Whiskey Wall. And so we've taken the show on the road. I mean, we've been blessed to have the first guy in the door at the Pulse nightclub shooting on the show, survivors of the Dallas 5 killings. We've had the Aurora movie theater massacre, the guy that ran the bomb squad and was in there checking for bodies underneath. We had Jeff Heinrich, who was the police officer who was just wearing shorts and t-shirt and was on the football field watering the field at Parkland when the shooting started and ran in unarmed and started saving kids. I mean, we've had some unbelievable warriors on this show. And that's opened up just a lot of doors and allowed us to be in a position where we can help a lot of people and tell a lot of untold stories of heroes.
Yeah, it blows me away because that we seem to focus, and same thing with, let's take, for example, national health or PTSD, workman's comp presumption. Every time you get something that is developed to help the masses, there's always this focus on that 5% of shitbags that abuse it. And this, it seems like we've been dragged in that with specifically with law enforcement now, where, of course, we have seen on camera incidences where a police officer has done something pretty awful. We've heard the scandals out of LA and other areas where, yes, they were running drugs and, you know, but that compared to the entire police force of the US is a minuscule amount. Why do you think that people have grabbed onto that small amount of that profession and ignored, as you were saying, the 90 plus 95% of the force that's actually doing incredible things and risking their lives every day?
Because it's sexy in the headlines. I mean, listen, man, here's what it comes down to. In the United States, according to 2019 data, there are 328.3 million people. Now, there are 670,279 full-time police officers out of a total of about 900,000 sworn law enforcement officers. So when you do the math on that, that means that police officers are less than 0.21% of the population. So if we want to drill down into that more, officers come into contact with only 17% of the population annually, but that's a total of more than 53 million contacts. Now, when you run the numbers, 2016 police data shows that there were 26,000 excessive force complaints against officers. Now, I'm not saying that that's a number that was substantiated or ultimately proved to be legitimate. But even if you run that high number, that's 0.049% of all contacts. Now, of that, only 8% of those complaints were sustained, which is 0.0039% of all of them. So what that ultimately means is that you're 7 times more likely to be murdered, 15 times more likely to be killed in a traffic accident, or 42 times more likely to be raped than to have a police officer use excess force on you. But then if you look at the mainstream media and Hollywood and these liberal elites, what the conversations that they're having at this point now are the number of unarmed black men who are being shot and killed by police officers. But if you look at, so let's look at like 2015 data on police shootings, white individuals who were shot by police accounted for 50% of those shootings. Blacks, 26%, Hispanics, 17%. So the numbers actually show that the argument and the whole idea of we're kneeling for the flag because of police brutality against unarmed black men, it's not true. It's not legitimate. And we could dive into data all day long. I mean, we could go on and on, but the truth of it is that the numbers just don't add up and aren't quantified or substantiated based on the actual numbers and information.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that's never reported as well is all the, you know, the police departments that I've worked alongside in my career so far are a diverse group of men and women. But yeah. It always seems to be the white male shooting the minority that makes the news, you know, and then that to me is not only, you know, a slap in the face to all the white males on departments, unless, of course, it's one of those justified cases where the person did screw up and absolutely should be dragged through the coals. But sure. Also, I mean, what a position it puts into the other members of the department that don't fit that you know, race and sex that's being you know, demonized. I mean, it's like ignoring the other parts of the police department.
Absolutely. Well, and nobody's talking about the cultural issues that we face in society or the socioeconomic trends that have led to, you know, a decrease in the number of Black or Hispanic police officers. Like, all we want to do is take numbers and manipulate numbers to say that we have, you know, white cops shooting Black people. But it's not about race. I mean, if we could look past the color of people's skin and actually look at you know, number of homicides in various communities and violent crime, and really drill down into that, I think what we find is we don't have a problem based on color of Black versus white. We have a problem with cultures and with what's happening in society, and the numbers back that culture problem. And so if you look at FBI data, for example, Black Americans make up 13% of the population, but according to the same FBI data, they account for 50% of murders and 38% of violent crime overall. Is it because they're Black? No, it's not. It has nothing to do with the color of your skin. We do have to look at what's happening in our cultures that has led to this divide, because the only way that we can really combat racism in America and the impact of that and the fallout is by getting to the bottom of what's happening in our country and why we have this divide.
Yeah. Well, a couple of areas that I've addressed on this show so far. One is drugs. And obviously, as I'm sure the guests have been on your show and I'm sure you've seen with your own eyes, the drug epidemic in this country is hands down a huge contributor to overall crime, whether it's the power of selling them, whether it's the addiction and the crime that comes from those. And I had one of the gentlemen who spearheaded the decriminalization of drugs in Portugal, and they went from the highest level of addiction in Europe to the lowest within 10 years. And then I had another, gentleman from Norway who do their prison system very differently. The complete maniac psychopaths are still locked away the same as we do. But the other, you know, the lower tier ones, they have an open prison system where they have no freedom. They're on an island or somewhere where they can't get out, but they live like a community. So by the time they come out, there's training for jobs. They're living in houses. They have to clean for themselves, cook for themselves. And so you're rehabilitating, and you look at the statistics of our prisons here. You know, every year you can tell it's just getting worse and worse and worse. Our prison population is growing far greater than the population of the country. So from my very, you know, basic non-expert eyes, if we don't fix the fundamental causes of crime in the first place, we are making the roles of the first responder more and more dangerous, you know, with that epidemic in itself.
Brother, I totally agree with you. And I think part of the problem is that we get so caught up in identity politics that we can't have those real conversations about how to combat this. I mean, listen, when we were growing up, my dad's side is Puerto Rican. So my abuelos are, you know, darker than most people that I know. We weren't raised to see a difference in color or in, you know, different ethnicities. We were taught you judge people. OK, but you judge people on whether or not they're an asshole. That's it. Like, it's as simple as that. And that's something that doesn't know gender or sex or race or ethnicity or sexual preference or anything like that. And if we're going to really drill down into prison reform and combating the opioid crisis here in America, we have to be able to look past race and ethnicity and gender and sexual orientation and all of that, and make decisions based on data and begin attacking it at the core. I mean, we could have conversations all day long about the fentanyl crisis and, you know, the problem that we face with cocaine and crystal meth and whatever. But if we don't look at the fact that we have a problem with prescription drugs here in America, then we're missing the boat. You know, you look at the way that antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication are handed out to even little kids now, we are masking a lot of the problems instead of addressing the problems. And over time, that has led to a fundamental shift on our culture and the violent crime rates that we have here in America.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the most kind of obvious, complete, you know, dropping of the ball is the obesity crisis. You know, we're up in arms about terrorism, for example, as we should be. I mean, this is coming from a guy who grew up in England when the IRA were blowing up my people.
Yep.
But those numbers are still, if you want to look just statistically, are minute compared to the people that we're losing, you know, from smoking, from obesity, from all these things that are completely preventable. But yet, look totally at what we are feeding our children in the schools.
Totally. I mean, okay, yeah, we could ban all the guns in America, right? That'll work. Or we could ban Big Macs and ice cream. I mean, why is nobody having that conversation considering the obesity rates and the number of people who are dying from heart disease? So we don't want to have conversations based on logic. We want to have knee-jerk reactions when we see scary things happen.
Yeah, yeah, instead of education and prevention. And I think that's another area is people look at, you know, what's going to happen now. It's almost that economic drive-through mentality where it's like, I want it now, 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 instead of realizing that you've got to invest. And our, you know, one generation might be screwed. It might be too late. But if we start at the generation that's entering the world now, maybe one or two generations later, we won't have, you know, a morbidly obese population. The kids are dying younger than their parents.
I totally agree. Now, let's also be clear. I'm not actually championing to get rid of Big Macs or ice cream or bacon. I would go to war over bacon. But I do think you're right. Education is a key component. And again, if you look at the cultural differences in different communities, we see different levels of education as it pertains to health and fitness.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, there's a guy I'm trying to get on because we always hear how Finland is number one in education. And I'm still working on getting a lot of communication at the moment. But why are we not finding out what they're doing and using the same model here? Now, I know in the speeches I've seen him make so far, at no point are they saying Finnish teachers are better than American teachers. They're saying it's the system that they're working in. So when we know that, you know, Portugal has a great solution for the drug epidemic, and you know, it may not transfer over perfectly, but when we see these other nations, to me, it almost seems like our arrogance kind of gets in the way of just saying, okay, you know, this country, you clearly have a better way of doing it. Can you show us how we can adopt it in our nation?
I totally agree. We are a pretty stubborn country at scale. And we're also, you know, I guess by design, we are slow to move based on the way that our company was structured. If you look at the legislative process, for example, it's designed to be slow. But it also wasn't designed taking into consideration the polarization. I don't believe that we face today because more so than anything, social media and the spread of fake news and people screaming louder than everybody else.
Yeah. So you mentioned about behind the uniforms. I'm kind of interested to see with all those men and women that you had on so far, what were some of the common denominators that you were hearing from all these stories from these people?
So one that is a very common trend is faith. That's something that hit really close to home for me. We have Houston Gass, for example. He was a police chief out in Texas. And Houston, when he was a patrol officer, he took a 12-gauge shotgun blast to the face and survived to tell about it. So we've launched a new series with Houston called The Thin Blue Blood, where Houston interviews other officers who were shot or stabbed in the line of duty and talks to them about the road to recovery and the way that faith has played a role in their recovery as well. And so sort of seeing the hand of God in a lot of these people's lives has been really encouraging and inspiring. Another component is selflessness. You know, the media will have you believe that police hate black people, gay people, women, like whatever, this whole identity politics game. But there's not a single officer that I have ever met. And we work with departments all across the country, not just with the show, but as an agency. And I have never once met a single person who would pull somebody over because of what they look like. They'll pull you over if you're speeding, or for a variety of other reasons. But in most cases, they have no idea what you look like until they've pulled you over. And so that sort of selflessness to run into burning buildings or run into shootings or war zones without thinking about the impact that it'll have on their life, but rather just thinking about how can I save people, regardless of what they look like or what they believe in, that has definitely been a common thread.
Right. And you make a very good point. And I've said this on the show before as well, when I've talked to, you know, one of the law enforcement people that I have on, is as a fireman, you know, we get to pull up on scene. Yes, there's some unknowns, but you, with your own eyes, you say, okay, here's my danger. I can identify it. Here's a potential danger. But it amazes me, especially here in Florida, where we have such bright sun, the dark, dark tints that you have on a lot of the vehicles. The courage it takes just to walk up to a vehicle when most of these men and women have no idea if there's a weapon aimed right at them as they're walking up. Yeah. So then to say, oh, you pulled me over because I was X, you're absolutely right. A lot of these, you know, these traffic stops, they have no idea who's driving because you physically cannot see through the window.
Totally. It's spot on. And that has been a common theme again and again and again, which is that they have no idea what they look like. And then they get up there and there's a huge threat to their life.
Yeah. Now, let me just be clear as well. I've had many, you know, law enforcement officers in this area die. We've had them, you know, from traffic stops that were murdered, many, many of them in the Orlando area. So, you know, when we see these reports and, oh, you know, the brutality of the police, I've seen, you know, friends die. You know what I mean? So there is that visible opposite side of the story. So what do you think are the solutions to improving education? And again, I'm not saying about bowing down to any group that's putting pressure, but educating people on you know, what these men and women really do.
So I think we need to continue to tell stories, but I think we need to capture kids at a younger age. We just covered a story about a school in New Jersey that there was a contest, a coloring contest for little kids that's put on annually by the American Legion. And the school did not allow, or wasn't going to until parents raised just a storm. They weren't going to let the kids take part because it showed various members of the service holding their rifles and was celebrating the, I want to say, 50 or 100 year anniversary. They said that the sight of guns was too triggering and highly inappropriate for students. We are rewriting the history books, and we are no longer teaching students what it takes to defend freedom and to earn and keep freedom, but we're instead telling kids that freedom is earned by wearing vagina hats and marching in the streets, and that is not what it takes to earn and preserve freedom. So I think that the education needs to change tremendously. You said the show was sort of no holds barred, I guess. So I think we have to do something about the pussification of America as a whole. The fact that we are no longer making decisions based on facts. We are making decisions based on feelings and emotions. That absolutely needs to change. And we need to build relationships between kids and law enforcement officers much sooner and stop this narrative that police are the bad guys.
Yeah. And I think another area that I see is that you've got, like you said, the all the way to the left, if we're doing that scale, where, you know, it's, you know, triggered by everything. But then you've got all the way to the right, where it's, you know, violence solves everything. And again, that middle ground is you've got to have that compassion. You can't run around punching everyone in the face, but you've also got to be the kind of person who can be a protector in their community as well.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, let's look at the school shooting debate for a second. You've got people on the far right saying arm every single teacher, and then you have people on the far left saying every school should be a gun-free zone. Well, both ideas are stupid, quite frankly, because we know that gun-free is simply a target. There's, you know, no criminal is going to see a sign that says gun-free zone and be like, oh my God, I guess I can't go in there to shoot the place up. But on the flip side, man, I'll tell you what, a lot of the teachers that I had should never be allowed near a firearm because they're going to be afraid of it. They're not going to be properly trained. They won't know how to properly stow or use, for that matter, a firearm. And so the polarization of America has come to such an extreme that we need to find the solution that's somewhere in the middle that cuts through that polarization.
Yeah, it was a difficult decision for me, but I actually ended up buying a firearm myself. And I grew up with guns on the farm, but they were hunting guns. And then when I came over here, it was a kind of a weird transition because I was, you know, I was just seeing all the results of the violence. But I have to give credit to Tim Kennedy, who I've had on a couple of times now. But when, again, you realize that as we are now, as the nation stands, and as everyone knows, every shitbag has some sort of weapon, you know, it's a contradiction of terms almost, but you have to be a peacemaker at the moment, you have to be able to be capable of violence to defend yourself or the innocents.
Absolutely, man. We've gotten very soft as a society, and that terrifies me.
Yeah, well, just shifting the focus for a moment, because I want to kind of be balanced, I guess, in the perspective. We've talked about, obviously, some of the police officers that are out there doing an incredible job. What are some of the common denominators you're seeing of these officers that are completely, criminally taking lives or these bad eggs that we're seeing? You seeing any common denominators there?
No, I think in a lot of cases, if you look at the numbers and you look at the quote unquote bad cops or the people who are convicted, in a lot of cases, we've seen that the state that we are in from a media perspective is leading to convictions that might not otherwise be convictions. So I have seen members of our service who have been, basically turned into enemies of the country because rules of engagement changed the day before they had to make a difficult decision. There are always going to be bad apples in every single industry. I'm not saying there aren't bad and dirty cops. I'm not saying that there aren't bad and dirty marketing agencies, firefighters, teachers, attorneys, you name it, you'll find them in every single industry. But the bigger problem is that the media is perseverating on the one or two really bad apples and using it to cast a, you know, sort of a broad brush that every single person looks like that.
Yeah. Well, an area that I see, and we see it in the fire department too, and it worries me, it really does, is when, especially now, when I know that many of the police departments are probably struggling to recruit because of the whole, you know, impression of their profession. But for us in the fire service as well, it's, you know, this is a profession where some of these men and women in the fire side are working 56 hours a week as their base before they're then forced to stay at other shifts because they're not staffing their departments properly. And the point being, you're creating this environment that then is encouraging mistakes. So what I mean by that is, you know, the higher levels of stress, the sleep deprivation, the lack of training. And so I think an area that if we really want to fix some of the quote unquote errors that we see in our officers, then we need to staff them correctly. We need to pay them properly. We need to train them. We need to give them the right equipment, because a lot of these departments are working on, you know, qualifying a range once, twice a year with six shots, understaffed, being forced to work, you know, double shifts. And then when you pull over a teenager, that reaction of whether you think that he's reaching for his license or his firearm, you know, is a split second. And I think some of these things that we're seeing on video are most likely because these men and women are just exhausted.
I completely agree. Training is a huge problem. Understaffing is a big problem. When you have departments, whether they be police or fire, that are already understaffed by 10 or 20 or 30%, and you've got firefighters and cops working constant overtime just to provide coverage for the city or the town that they're in, of course you're going to have a deficit with training. And then when you see the budgets slashed further, you know, we now see a debate over whether or not we should even have SROs in schools in states like Nebraska. When we whittle away the value of our emergency responders and we fail to provide them training, but then we say, well, why was it that innocent bystander was shot? Well, I don't know. Maybe you should have at least provided some kind of advanced training or ongoing training to these departments. You will see that. And do we blame the officer for that? Do we blame the firefighter who fell short in saving a life because he wasn't properly trained? It's a real problem that we're going to continue to face as we see more and more staffing shortages and we see more and more budget cuts on basic things like training.
Yeah, and that's an area that really frustrates me is, again, like we're talking about the obesity thing, is that short-sighted perspective with the finances. So, for example, the way they work the fire departments now, there's a huge amount of ill health. There's a lot of injuries, a lot of disabilities, there's a lot of, you know, suicides now, and it's horrendous. And you could take the cost, even if you had no concern for human life, just take the cost of what this police department or the fire department is costing you with all those areas and front load it so that you have better hours, you have better training. You are actually going to reduce all those injuries and deaths, and then ultimately probably save a huge amount of money in your department, as well as being, you know, the humanitarian and actually caring about your people.
Of course. I mean, you're also going to be fixing morale problems as well. And morale can have a huge negative impact on staffing, on health costs, on people calling out sick, on overtime. So if we can simultaneously work on fixing the morale, we're going to have a fundamental shift for the better in these departments.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, you mentioned the schools. I just want to touch on one thing quickly. With all, again, your immersion in the law enforcement side, what would be your perspective on the ideal solution for, you know, as it stands? I mean, I hope one day that we don't have to have, you know, armed people everywhere, but that's obviously, you know, generations away. But what's the solution for 2019 to protect our kids in our schools?
So first of all, I actually sit on a federal task force on school and workplace shootings dubbed Operation Innocence, which is focused on finding common sense solutions to stop school shootings. And there, I mean, this, man, we could go on for hours about this, but, you know, high level, I would say we have fire drills at schools all the time, right? Where we teach the kids what to do in the event of a fire. When was the last time there was a fire in a school that burned down a school and killed anybody? Probably what, back in maybe the 60s at scale? And yet we're not running active killer drills and teaching kids how to cope with that. We have stopped working on building relationships between teachers and students and the parents and community. Kids don't have soft skills anymore. We have anti-bullying programs that are trying to teach kids that bullying doesn't exist or try and prevent it from happening, as opposed to giving them coping mechanisms to be able to deal with it when it does. I was bullied all the time growing up. I was taught how to deal with it and how to protect myself. And I wasn't taught that it's not going to happen and you should run away from it when you see it, because that's not reality. Then we have the whole idea of gun-free zones in schools, which are wildly ineffective. We have schools that are wide open that don't have any security measures and have no hardening in the schools whatsoever. So there is no one solution. There are a whole lot of steps that need to be taken, from a physical protection, from a, you know, I do believe that armed security is crucial, because the truth of it is that, as cliche as it sounds, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun every single time, or that bad guy turning the gun on himself or herself. And so it's not, there is no just one solution, but we can't seem to find these solutions because bureaucrats get involved and you have a bunch of proposals on the table that, because we're so polarized, we can't find anything in the middle.
No. And then you talk about that. I mean, that drives me crazy as well. It takes years of meetings to figure out something that is just a common sense solution that you could have agreed with that same day.
It's unbelievable, man.
Yeah. So you mentioned about the school. I had an exposure to my son's school. I was dropping him off after a doctor's appointment, and they had a code red. And they do drills there. You know, they have run the active killer scenario many times, and it's terrifying for a freaking, you know, elementary school kid to have to even go through that. But what was so weird, as a first responder that's used to drilling on the outside, the response was I was locked in the school, and then we kind of go into the supply closet while it happened, and the lack of communication. Like, the only person that knows what's going on the outside is the principal. That's it. They don't communicate with any of the teachers. So these poor kids are terrified. These poor teachers are terrified, and they have no idea if this person's going to come through, if it's going to be a false alarm. And that ended up being a false alarm. But then the same week, we had that actual shooting in one of our other schools here in Ocala. But I think there's no question in my mind, seeing how vulnerable they were at that point, that an armed officer in every school is the solution, because then it becomes a deterrent as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to start focusing on not politics, but on saving kids' lives.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then let's move forward to Whiskey Patriots. So I know that's another whiskey area that you're passionate about. So tell me about that.
You know, the irony, brother, is that it has nothing to do with whiskey, really. So the name the Whiskey Patriots started because when our founding fathers were drafting the Constitution, they didn't have easy access to clean drinking water. And so they sipped whiskey, which was also, frankly, a form of currency back then. And so to us, the name the Whiskey Patriots, it's a tribute to the founding principles of our country. Do you stand for America and our Constitution and doing the right thing? Do you stand behind our veterans and our emergency responders? If so, then you're a whiskey patriot.
Right. Well, another area you talk about, which is this kind of intrigues me as well, because I hear it a lot, is the whole kind of millennial thing. I know you are a part of that generation yourself.
Why you got to call me out on that?
Because you say in your bio.
I'm one of the good ones.
So, but that's it. So that's an interesting concept to me because, you know, the fire departments, the police departments are full of millennials. The military is full of millennials. You know, there's a lot of these men and women that are out there, you know, acting in a very, very mature and adult capacity. But yet we've got this very negative connotation of this generation. And the part that kind of makes me chuckle a little bit is that that generation was raised by the generation that's complaining about them.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, listen, there are good millennials and there are bad millennials. There are good generation X, Y, Z, whatever, and there are bad ones. We have a vetting process at my company that the media lovingly referred to as the snowflake test. And the whole idea is that it's 30 questions, short answer essay style, to make sure that we don't have whiny, entitled snowflakes come work for us. But a millennial can be really any generation. It's, you know, age-wise, it's people born largely accepted 1980 to 2000. But mindset-wise, it could be anybody. A snowflake or a millennial aren't limited by age. They're limited by mindset.
Yeah, because I've witnessed many times, basically a turd in a fire station sitting on a lazy boy, you know, with chip dust all over his guts talking about snowflakes, and the guy can't even climb into the rig on his own. You know what I mean? So it's definitely not an age thing.
Totally. I have identified the moment that millennials fell apart and society began to collapse. Are you ready for this?
I am.
It was when they added the save button onto video games.
So that way you didn't have to earn your way back up.
Bingo. So, I mean, growing up, man, when I was a little kid, we had ColecoVision and then we had Atari. Like if you got killed at level 17, you had to bust your ass to get back to level 17 and spend the whole day doing it again. And then Nintendo and Sega Genesis, we added that little save button. And now all of a sudden you could die and start back right where you were. That save button in video games started turning us into a bunch of lazy buffoons. I'm convinced that was the moment right there. Let it go down in the history books, brother.
You know, video games are responsible for a lot. Have you heard Dave Grossman's theory on video games and the school shootings?
I have not.
Oh my goodness. So, I mean, so when it first came up, people were like, oh, it's the violent movies and video games. And it was easy to kind of roll your eyes and go, well, it can't just be that. And obviously it's not saying it's just that, but the way those first person shooters are the same basic kind of training, you know, online training modality they use in a lot of the military training. And they've had shootings where these kids have never basically hardly ever fired a pistol. They maybe bought them and fired a few shots off a few days before the shooting and got like six shots off with six headshots. And all they'd done is play video games. And the other side, back to what we were talking about before, which I think is even more pertinent, is, you know, when do kids play video games? All through the day and all through the night. So now you add the sleep deprivation and the psychosis and then the psych meds, and now you've got this perfect storm. And then eliminate the compassion side because you're conditioned. It's a game. You just get points. And then add in the fact that you want to be the school shooter that has higher kills than the last school shooter, because again, you've got that video mentality, and all of a sudden, all those elements come together and you're like, holy shit, that does all make sense.
That's a spectacular point. I could totally buy into that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no one element, but there's definitely, you know, there's a lot of merit to that.
Love it.
All right. Well, this has been, you know, an awesome conversation. Is you know, it's different than we normally have. Like I said, it's normally a first responder or a member of the military, but I've really valued your opinion because you are immersed in our community, but from a different perspective.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that very much. It was, you know, sort of on parting thoughts when Robert, the founder of Law Enforcement Today, reached out to me about a year and a half ago. You know, we've been doing some work together at that point. And he said, we'd like to make you our national spokesman. I said, yeah, you know, I'm not a cop, right? He said, yeah, I know. I said, and I never have been. He goes, no, I know that. I said, okay, I'm not following you. He said, you could do one thing that we as police officers can't do. I said, what's that? He goes, you could run your mouth and no department can fire you. And he was right. You know, our emergency responders really don't have the First Amendment like every other civilian does. And so I think it's really important to have that voice and to give a voice and a home to our emergency responders and to, frankly, all those who serve and protect our communities and our country.
Yeah, well, I thank you. I've got a few closing questions, if that's all right, just to pick your brain on a few things.
Sure.
So the first one, we're talking about a book, so why don't we start with that? What's the book going to be called, and when do you think you're going to be releasing it?
It is called Here Comes the Snowplow, and it is a story about how embracing conservatism and Christianity can actually grow your business. I am just about done writing it, and so we're probably looking at second quarter.
Brilliant. Actually, you just reminded me of one thing I want to ask you about, speaking of generations. So an observation that I used to work in a pool between my fire shifts, trying to earn some extra money on the side. And where we are in Florida, obviously, there's a lot of retirees. And I observed a really interesting kind of observation, I guess, for lack of a better word. You had these men and women that, you know, elderly men and women that were in the pool, and you hear them bitching. Oh, yeah, the water's too cold. Apples are too expensive, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then over the next few weeks, you learn that, you know, they flew gliders in World War II and they were in, you know, Normandy. So it was so bizarre because, again, these men and women were, you know, the people that we look up to. But you see a lot of the older generation. It's like they seem to have lost that perspective, and that bar has kind of been changed for them again. And I think that's an area I think that we should look at in our society is, if you can fight in Europe and truly defend the world, and then a few decades in your country and you're back complaining about apples again, that's an interesting perspective on how we think and maybe how our priorities have changed from, you know, the protector role to the materialistic philosophy that a lot of us have these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. I also think if anybody has earned that, it's a lot of these men and women. I mean, I can't tell you how many cops I know who have a countdown to the minute of when they're going to be able to retire because they've seen so much and they've been through so much. But if you think about where we are in society these days, it's the old bread and circus mentality, right? Where you don't have to think about the difficult things if you're given the simple things like bread and circus. It's that old ancient Roman way.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. All right. So we talked about your book. Is there a book that you love to recommend to people? Can be about what we've discussed today or something completely different.
Oh my God. I mean, so the guys who are publishing my book, it's a publishing company called Tactical 16. Veteran owned and operated, started because the guy that started the company went off to serve our country after September 11th, when we lost 16 acres of U.S. soil. And so they put out a lot of great stories. There's a spectacular radio show and podcast that Law Enforcement Today puts out. And you could check that out on lawenforcementtoday.com. That's actually where we have a lot of the behind the uniform stuff is on Law Enforcement Today on Facebook. There's so much content out there, man, that it can be really difficult to weed through it. But I would definitely use Law Enforcement Today as a great resource because they've got some unbelievable stories of patriots and emergency responders from across the country.
Brilliant. All right. So the same question, is there a movie and or documentary that you love?
Well, I'm a really big fan of House of Cards, and I'm really upset that, you know, Kevin Spacey's now done and that show is over. But in terms of documentaries, I actually consume very, very little content. My agency produced about 10,000 videos last year. And so candidly, man, I wish I could give you some great, amazing answer. But the truth is that we produce so much content that I consume so little content.
No problem at all. All right. So then next one, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast to speak to the first responders and military of the world?
Oh, geez. I mean, I could give you so many guys. I can give you Ken Krause, who was the first Marine Guard hostage in the Iran crisis before anybody knew that there was an Iran crisis. I can give you John Valla, who was the guy that ran the bomb squad in Aurora during the movie theater massacre. I mean, I have so many patriots that I can give you. Eli Crane, the CEO of Bottle Breacher, who was a former Navy SEAL sniper. I could give you Sal DeFranco, who Navy SEAL, who his head was run over stateside. He was in a coma for months. They thought he was going to die. And now he and his wife are opening up a bunch of coffee shops called Battlegrounds Coffee. I can give you so much content, brother, that you're going to call me and ask me to stop sending you people.
Excellent. Well, I've already you helped me up with Eli before, and we're going to reconnect, I think, next month and talk about
it. Excellent.
So, yeah, he should definitely be coming on, but I'll definitely hit you up for some more. Fantastic. Thank you. All right. So then the last one before we talk about where we can find you and all your projects, what do you do to decompress when you're not running all these different areas?
I really like smoking meats. My wife got me a smoker a few years ago, Traeger. Traeger actually sponsors the Federal Task Force on School and Workplace Shootings too, so shameless plug there. So I love smoking steaks and briskets and tenderloins and pork, you name it. I'm very blessed to have two little girls and, you know, either a little boy or a little girl on the way. So I love spending time with my wife and kids, and I love hitting the gym. I'm also a big fan of, I read a lot of, Thor novels, not like Brad Thor. So I do that occasionally. I travel a lot for work though. So, I'm constantly working, and we do a lot of work in the nonprofit arena as well. So I love the opportunity to be able to give back.
Beautiful. Well, firstly, congratulations on being pregnant again.
Thank you so much. I just look pregnant. My wife's the one who's actually pregnant.
And what does your workout look like in the gym?
It's usually about an hour of powerlifting followed by a half hour of high intensity interval training with either sprinting or some form of cardio.
Brilliant. All right. So then the very last question, where can people find you, reach out to you, all those areas online?
Facebook.com/KyleReyesCEO. That's where I put out a lot of our fire content. Kyle Scott Reyes on Instagram. Kyle Reyes on LinkedIn, lawenforcementtoday.com, thewhiskeypatriots.com. If they're looking for the most patriotic and badass marketing agency in America, that's my company, The Silent Partner Marketing. Or you could just, you know, find me wherever. You can see me. I do a lot of stuff in the mainstream national news. So we get lots of trolls after that. I love when people send me trolling emails.
Yeah, I always say I wish people had would use the energy they have on trolling or arguing about, you know, politics and actually put it into compassion and kindness in their community. Then the world would literally change.
I agree. And listen, any of your emergency responders who've got great stories to tell, tell them to bring a bottle of whiskey to the People's Republic of Connecticut. We'll sit down and share a cocktail and some stories on Behind the Uniforms.
Brilliant. Maybe I'll let you know if I'm up that way.
Done deal, man. Actually, I kind of like to come down to Florida instead.
Oh yeah, we could do that too. We might start a wall here.
Perfect.
All right, well, Kyle, thank you so much. It's been such a great conversation. I really enjoyed listening to your perspective, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, brother. Be safe. God bless.